Celebrities who want publicity can go to Hello Magazine, sycophantic but naff, or they can be brave and submit themselves to the big beasts of the broadsheets. And there lies danger. The big beasts may love you, they may loathe you, and you won't know until you see it in print. On Between Ourselves today, we're joined by two of the sharpest celebrity interviewers in the business, Lynn Barber of The Observer and Nigel Farndale of The Sunday Telegraph. Lynn, why do people agree to be interviewed knowing the risks?
I never know, actually. I think perhaps it's a challenge, and I do have a reputation for being very accurate, so I mean, they're not going to be misquoted if they go with me. Also, there is a possibility, quite often fulfilled, that we might get on, you know. And lots of people who seem to be perceived as rude by other interviewers, I'm thinking of somebody like Michael Winner, you know, we're bosom friends now since I interviewed him. So it doesn't always work in their disfavour.
Nigel, why do they take the risk?
I think, as Lynn says, it is, some do regard it as a challenge, because if you go for a sycophantic interview in Hello magazine, it's not going to reflect particularly well on you. It might show you as being a bit of a coward, if anything. Whereas in a fairly robust interview where you're going to be asked all the awkward questions, you know, you're going to probably come out of it looking quite good in the end. You may not always like what's written, but people will think the better of you for it.
But Lynn, just looking at some of the dangers, I mean, most of the people you interview come across well and you like them.
Yeah.
But you've dismissed Harriet Harman in print as thick, Claire Short as a clot, William Rees-Mogg as of the dare-to-be-dull school of journalism whose only unusual feature was its strong streak of self-advertisement. Do they speak to you afterwards, these people?
No. But I mean, I don't think they spoke to me before. I mean, it's not that I betrayed a friend or something. They're just people I went along, met once, didn't like, and tough, you know.
And Nigel, just turning to some of yours, I mean, Michael Parkinson, Elton John complained about interviews, and Sir Tim Rice said that he would punch you on the nose. Are you concerned when people react like that?
Well, not really. I think for someone like Elton John, it's par for the course. It's almost a game he plays. You would be disappointed if he didn't have a tantrum of some sort. And I think what he objected to in the interview I did with him was, I watched him in rehearsal. It was quite an intimate moment. It was down in the south of France. And he actually did have a tantrum of sorts with an engineer who failed to fix the pedal on his piano quick enough. And so I naturally sort of reported this and welcomed it as an insight into his true nature. And he took this as being a case of me having an agenda before I arrived, that I wanted to report this side of things. But I think he quite enjoys it. I think it's a game he likes to play with the media.
What's the worst sin that an interviewee can commit?
Being boring.
Being boring.
Yeah, I think you do have to play the game. You know, you have to. In a way, funnily enough, the thing that's not a sin is to be sort of argumentative. I remember doing an interview with Jeffrey Boycott and actually ended up having two sort of points in the interview where we were properly arguing, which was extraordinary because he just didn't care really what I thought of him, which I thought was a refreshing change. And I liked him for that. I thought he was, you know, that reflected well in his character.
But Lynn, you'll forgive anything but being boring?
Yes. I mean, well, you see, if they're rude or horrible to me, like I interviewed Marianne Faithfull and she was just a nightmare the entire time and behaved very badly to a waiter in a restaurant and one thing or another, I just think, oh, yippee, I'm going to enjoy writing this so much. You know, I mean, you're giving it me on a plate.
Gotcha.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, Lynn, turning specifically to you, you've worked as a celebrity interviewer for various papers, but for 9 years now for The Observer. What kind of person do you have to be to do this job? What kind of person are you?
Well, I think of myself as first and foremost as a writer. And in a way, doing interviews is what I have to do in order to have something to write about, if you see what I mean. I mean, I wouldn't swap places with you because I want to be writing. I think you have to be incredibly nosy. And I think that that's a sort of quality that I've had through my entire life, which doesn't show any signs of fading, even at my ripe old age. And really wanting to understand other people and not often succeeding, you know. I mean, I think what I'm writing about is the attempt to understand somebody rather than actually understanding them. But I think the readers can go along with that.
Do you bring your own life experience into your interviews?
I suppose I do a bit in that I have sort of current obsessions in my own life, which I suppose feed into the question sometimes. When I was young, when I started interviewing, I had small daughters and I was very obsessed with sibling rivalry, so I probably would have asked interviewees about that. Now I'm an empty nester and my husband died a year and a half ago, so I suppose I would feel competent to tackle the subject of bereavement if it was appropriate. Although, oddly enough, very soon after my husband died, the paper sent me to interview Jane Clark, who was Alan Clark's widow. I think they thought that we would bond in that way. But actually, she was sort of still mourning her husband and talking to his grave 4 years after he died, and this just filled me with horror, you know. So far from bonding, it was a rather sort of alienating experience.
Well, reading your interviews with people, outrageous people
yes.
often emerge most positively. People like Julie Birchall, Julian Clary, Anne Robinson.
Yes.
Why?
Oh, I like big characters. You know, I really like sort of prima donna-ish. I wouldn't put Julian Clary in that bracket because he's a sweetie and very easy to get on with, I think. But I mean, I can cope with quite badly behaved people. And in a way, I'm more comfortable with those sorts of people. And the people I'm not good at interviewing are sort of very nice, reasonable, middle-class people.
Well, they make boring copy.
Well, they do for me. I mean, they don't necessarily, but they do for me.
But do you get people who are too outrageous, say like Richard Harris?
Well, that was all good fun. He was playing with himself the whole time I was interviewing him.
You mean literally playing with himself?
I don't know what he was doing. He was sort of had his hand down inside his tracksuit. I think he was just hanging on to himself is what I want to convey.
It was a comfort thing.
Yes, it's you see little boys doing it at playgroup all the time, you know, but you don't normally see a 60-year-old famous actor.
I mean, basically he shouted and roared and entertained the whole of the Savoy Grill until the waiter told him to be quiet.
Yes, he was just being actory, though, I think. He'd been sort of sitting, talking quite quietly, and nobody was paying him any attention in the lobby of the Savoy apart from me. And suddenly realised that there was this potential audience who needed to get the full Richard Harris treatment, you know. So I think I asked if he was vain or something. And he suddenly started shouting, "Do you think I'm vain?" And I said, "Yes," you know. And then he shouted louder and louder, and he was trying to get other people involved, and he was just trying to make a scene. But I think that was because he's an actor and he hadn't had mass attention.
But he did manage even to embarrass you, didn't he?
Well, I did scuttle away rather fast, yes.
And then there are people who can annoy you by being late or not turning up for their appointments with you, like, I mean, Jeremy Irons.
Oh, yes.
Jeremy did pay, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Well, not enough. I want to interview him again. Actually, I'll tell you something about him. I started this interview by saying I don't want to be fair to Jeremy Irons. I just want to boil him in oil. I got the sweetest letter from him afterwards saying, "My wife really enjoyed your interview with me and agreed with every word." So I think he has got a sense of humour, at least.
Well, obviously, one of the things that you try to do is to show the difference between the public and the private face. And I'm just thinking of the interview with Felicity Kendall. And you said about her, "I do feel this undercurrent in Felicity Kendall, a deeply buried aggression that wants to scream, 'I hate you,' but puts on a sweet face and behaves politely because that's what she's been taught to do."
Yes. I mean, I think probably I said that because I couldn't actually quote anything she'd said that would sort of back that up, and I actually just had to say that is my hunch, you know. But I think this is partly to do with being experienced. I do now trust my hunches, and if you get a really sort of strong feeling from somebody of hatred or depression, or I think trust it actually.
Do you ever look back and feel, I was a bit hard?
Well, there was one where I regretted. It was Spike Milligan, just that he obviously was very depressed and it took the form of being very sour and everything he said was very nasty. He sort of said nasty things about other people, about other races and all sorts of things. And I sort of thought, I wish I didn't have to publish this. And it was one of those cases where there was a gap, you know, I mean, I had to write something, but I sort of regretted that. I don't think I've regretted anything else.
Turning to you, Nigel Farndale, you've been doing celebrity interviews now for about 9 years for the Sunday Telegraph. Nigel, thinking about the sort of person one needs to be to do this sort of work, what sort of person are you?
It's, funnily enough, a very good question, one that I always like to ask people how to describe themselves. And it's, of course, almost impossible to answer because it's not always easy to know yourself well. I'm very tolerant, I think, and fairly calm, but with the usual neurosis under the surface. I think in terms of interviewing style, I take a slightly different approach to Lynn in that I do prefer to have a conversation of sorts with people. I don't plan a set of questions. I like to sort of see where it goes, and often the supplementary question, which you hadn't occurred to you beforehand, is often the most revealing. And using things like silence and just the power of listening attentively can be very rewarding, as can just asking a simple why as a supplementary question to a sort of, you know, long prepared answer that someone's just given you.
And are there things that you bring, personal experience that you bring, particular questions, for instance, that because of your own experience you'll always ask?
I suppose I've always wanted my father's approval possibly more than my mother's, and so when I'm talking to men, I do sometimes wonder if that applies to other people, and it often does. I remember one particular incident with Nicholas Parsons. We were talking about his relationship with his parents, and it suddenly became very affecting, the whole interview, and he actually started crying, and it seemed very genuine, and it emerged that his father had never quite approved of what he did, thinking it a very frivolous thing. And it was actually only on his deathbed that his father admitted that he'd seen Sail of the Century, this not very sort of impressive quiz show, and liked it. And it had sort of absolutely melted Nicholas Parsons' heart. And that was sort of a big step for him, I think.
Well, people who felt that they were betrayed by you, Michael Parkinson did. Tell us what happened there. I mean, you said he doesn't need to say it directly, but clearly he believes he's the best bloody interviewer in the world. Now, he objected.
Yes, I mean, the problem was, I think, where it's the role of the interviewer as interpreter of what the person has said. You know, you're not just reporting facts, you're actually having to stand back and offer opinions about what something means. In that case, I actually like Michael Parkinson. I thought he was good fun, but that objection he had to that interview, and he did take great exception to it. Firing off these furious letters to my editor, but it was really to do with he'd been talking, because he'd presented Des Down Dis for a while, and it hadn't been a great success, and he'd described Roy Plumley as being, he's not exactly the best bloody interviewer in the world, or something like that, and the implication was obviously that that's what he thought he was, and so it's a case of sort of, maybe I read too much into it, but I don't think I did, but he thought I did.
And Kissinger, wonderful description you had of Kissinger. You said that an interview with Henry Kissinger can seem a bit like taking dictation from a late period Henry James, dense yet precise passages of thought, bulging with sub-clauses and rhetorical questions delivered in a ponderous flat bass which reaches impossible depths, hundreds of leagues below the surface of normal speech, which does indeed describe that extraordinary bass voice, I know it. Yet, at the end of that interview, did it surprise you, at his age and having gone through all he went through, he obviously needed you desperately to understand him and to like him?
Well, I don't think it was me he needed to understand and like him. I think it was he needed the public via me. I think that's what his rationale. But I think he sort of has always one eye on posterity, on his legacy and the way the world will view him. It was one of those interviews where you had to steel yourself, because inevitably, if you interview Henry Kissinger, you have to ask about, you know, war crimes and
Cambodia.
Cambodia, and it's going to be a prickly encounter, but you've got to steel yourself and just get on and ask it. And I was quite surprised that the sort of how much he was prepared to talk about it and the detail he was prepared to go in. But obviously, in retrospect, he was wanting to set out his record in whatever, you know, even if it was just a magazine interview and not a great thick biography, he was still not going to pass up the opportunities to.
And sometimes
are they just a bit strange? I mean, William Hurt and some of the contacts you had before and after the interview, did you think he was just strange?
He has to be the strangest person I've ever interviewed.
And I've done him too, and he is definitely strange.
He is strange. Very strange. And I think he's a very complicated man. I mean, we were saying we're not really that keen on actors, but sometimes someone with as much texture as he has in his sort of psychological makeup can be fascinating. He suffers from, or he told me he suffers from a thing called logorrhea, which is a sort of inability to control your language. Everything comes out in a flood. And I met him in Prague. He was filming on location, and I actually ended up spending an evening with him, and we were staying at the same hotel, and we got up and had breakfast in the morning. So it was one of these sort of occasions when you can get to sort of feel you know a person.
But you got strange phone calls or text messages from him.
It was emails, actually. A couple of days after the interview, the email started, and every day there would be this huge sort of letter that would arrive, and it was pretty much gobbledygook. I mean, it was extraordinary and a bit disturbing. And in one of them, he said that he thought the media took celebrities and made them hostages in their space. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I got the feeling that I was somehow being held hostage in his space in this case. The letters, actually, the emails, some of them were quite sort of intimate. He was talking about his relationship with his daughter and stuff, but it was in such a sort of random stream of consciousness form that I couldn't really sort of relate to it.
Turning to you both, Lynn and Nigel, what's the thing you like best about the job?
It can be thrilling meeting your heroes. I mean, in my case, meeting Woody Allen was a sort of lifetime's ambition, and I wasn't disappointed. You know, that was wonderful, and the angst was all genuine, I discovered during the interview, which I was quite sort of reassured to discover.
Lynn?
Well, I love meeting people and having license to ask them very nosy questions. And occasionally it happens that I'm sort of sat next to somebody at a dinner party or something, and I think, oh, I wish I could interview them. I don't want to sort of just chat to them. I want to interview them. But it's as if all constraints are off when you're in an interviewing situation, and you can ask anything, however sort of impudent or nosy, whereas you can't in social life. And I have to sort of remind myself, you know, you're in social life now, not in an interview.
Yeah, I've found at dinner parties there is a danger you can forget yourself and start, if you become intrigued by someone's profession, a surgeon or something, you just question after question, and that's very sort of boorish and
but I mean, actually, social, really. As a girl, that was how I was sort of trained to conduct myself. I mean, I would always say, but what can I talk to him about? And friends would say, oh, you don't have to talk to men, you just ask them questions, you know. And it was sort of, how does the computer work or something like that. I think this is something that's my generation. I mean, I don't think it would be true of my daughters, for instance, but certainly the stance that you are finding somebody else terribly interesting and not saying very much yourself is one that's sort of quite familiar to me.
And negotiating beforehand for the interview, who's been the most difficult? And do people try to insist on pre-publication copy approval, seeing the thing before it goes in the paper?
Some people do try
but we don't allow it. You don't, do you?
No.
The Observer doesn't. Actually, I don't do my own negotiating anymore, but I mean, it is quite, especially with sort of real Hollywood stars, you know. I mean, there's negotiations about how much time has got to be spent talking about the film. There's negotiations about how much time you're going to spend with them, what subjects are taboo, which often, of course, is you know, gives you the clue as to what to ask about.
Yeah, exactly. it's a sort of green light, isn't it?
Yeah, don't mention her sister. You think, oh, she has a sister.
Yeah.
And who was the most difficult, Lynn?
What, negotiating-wise? Or
yeah.
I had fun once with Alan Clarke, that I said, well, shall I take you to lunch? And he said, what's the fee for this interview? And I said, well, I'm terribly sorry, we don't pay for interviews. And he said, oh, that's a bit bad. And I said, well, I'll take you to lunch, you know, the most lavish lunch you can dream up. And he said, well, tell you what, why don't you come to lunch here at Saltwood Castle? Except we don't eat lunch, so we won't actually give you any lunch. But why don't you send wine to the value of the lunch that you would have bought me if I'd said that I wanted to have lunch? And we agreed that this was sort of like £250 or something. And then he said, I won't give you any food when you get here. I'll give you some wine, but not the wine that you sent to us.
He
says, this is so careful, negotiations. But at least with that, you sort of knew what you were getting. I mean, I knew I was going down there at lunchtime and not getting any lunch.
And do you worry if you're left with them too long, that you might start to like them? Is there a danger there?
An hour or two is probably all you need to get a lot out of a person. And sometimes you can dread being left too long. I did an interview with Michael Schumacher in the Ferrari track at Bologna, and it all seemed rather sort of precarious, this arrangement. They said, oh, just turn up and we'll try and squeeze in some time. And he kept doing these sort of practice rounds. And I was sort of frantically trying to ask questions because I knew there were certain things one would have to cover. And so I'd sort of felt I'd covered all the things just from snatches of 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And then after all this, he came and sat down and said, right, okay. And it was sort of about an hour later, I was just sort of pulling my hair out.
So running out of questions.
He was very sort of, you know, it was a bit of a sort of energy vampire, really, sort of very sort of dull and cold and... Yeah,
some people
the color
are sort of
favorite color of car or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Some people are sort of exhausting, aren't they? Anita Roddick, have you ever done her?
No. I mean,
there's a sort of intensity where you just want to go and lie down after a bit, you know. But I recently interviewed Sir Alan Sugar in a horrible place called Boca Raton, Florida. And there'd been great negotiations beforehand about how long I could have, and it was going to be 90 minutes. So we were doing this interview, and I was sort of thinking in terms of 90 minutes. And he had a watch, one of those huge sort of chronometer things that you could fly a plane by, which he kept looking at the whole time, very ostentatiously, so sort of to remind me what a busy man he was and how valuable his time was. But after 90 minutes, he was still going on and sort of saying, next question, you know, ask. And he just went on and on and on. And I thought, well, this is weird. You know, we've had all these tight negotiations. And then his wife started saying, you know, Alan, we should be going. It's 3 o'clock. And he said, oh, my watch has stopped. And he was so furious with me. I mean, it was so unfair. I mean, if he'd asked me the time, I would have told him.
Talk to me about the technique that you adopt. I mean, it would seem to me, Lynn, that you come through as a personality more in your interviews, whereas it would seem to me, Nigel, that you rather stand back. Am I right?
I don't know. that's your impression. I don't know. What would you say? Do you mean I put myself too much in the way? I mean, I'm sorry if I do.
No, I don't mean that. But I mean, you write yourself into the piece.
I do, because I think an interview is a sort of transaction, and that how they treat me or how they respond to me is part of them. It sort of reveals stuff about them. I hope I don't write too much. I mean, that is a criticism that's made of my work.
Except I think because Lynn is so well known as an interviewer, I think readers read your pieces with an expectation of your particular take, you know, whereas I think I'm probably more anonymous as an interviewer, and they, you know, I can stand back a bit more, I think, and people don't have that expectation of my being a part of it.
I mean, I'm quite often told off for being judgmental. And I am judgmental. But, I mean, I notice in interviews, if I don't come to a conclusion about the person, if I don't make it clear that I either like them or don't, people are sort of disappointed by it and sort of say they felt there should have been another paragraph or something.
So, in a way, they do expect you to deliver a judgment, and usually a sharp one.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about usually a sharp one, but they expect a judgment, which could be a sharp one, yeah.
And I think it's more sort of honest doing that, isn't it? Because we make judgments about people all the time based on quite sort of superficial encounters. It's not that difficult. And if you just have the sort of the guts to put it down, and even if it's going to discomfort people, then that's your job.
Neither of you like interviewing actors. Why?
Well, they sort of blether, don't they? I mean, they'll give you, I mean, once, I quite like interviewing people where it's difficult to get anything out of them. Artists are wonderful from that point of view, you know, because you do feel that you're sort of hacking words out of them. Whereas artists sort of, actors sort of gush away. And then at the end of it, you think, what was that about? And the other fatal thing is that they tell anecdotes, which are very bad on the page, because while they're telling them to you, they might sound quite amusing and all the rest of it, and they put on different voices. But by the time you've transcribed that, it'll be completely flat, and it'll take about two pages.
And also they feel polished as well. I mean, what actors are good at is sort of giving the performance.
And slightly the attitude that they have of sort of, well, what do you want of me? I will give it you. You think, oh, dear, you know. And then they're so terrified of upsetting anyone or annoying anyone or committing to any point of view.
Their world is one in which everyone's darling this and darling that, so it tends to be a bit ingratiating.
Talk to me about personal remarks about people's appearance. I mean, Lynn, I'm thinking of your comment about Helena Bonham Carter's beauty, but also her slight moustache. Nigel, I'm thinking about you describing Gore Vidal's flies being open. I mean, in both cases, very humiliating for the interviewee. Was it necessary?
Well, I know that Helena Bonham Carter was very upset about it. I mean, I would have thought she knew that she had a slight moustache, and in a way that's part of her beauty.
And I think actually that perhaps it is a little cruel to draw attention to something like that, but it's also quite revealing because, you know, it as it turned out, shows her insecurities.
Yeah.
As for Gore Vidal's flies, I suppose it just seemed sort of
striking. I mean, something you noticed.
You couldn't really sort of ignore it, I suppose. Yeah. That was it. He's someone sitting in front of you with their legs and part of their flies down.
The main piece of advice, Lynn, that you would give to a young journalist moving in to interview famous people?
Just to remember that your loyalty is to your readers and that your transaction with the person you're interviewing is not what matters, that you shouldn't try and ingratiate yourself and become friends with the person you're interviewing, but you should try and remember all the time that you're there as a sort of delegate, really, for the readers.
Nigel?
Well, the first piece of advice is try and do it in the person's house, because there you get to see them in their context, as it were, and you get all these sort of little intimations of their real life around them. The second thing is I would say don't be intimidated, because you just got to remember that they're just the same as you, really. You know, we all have parents, we're all going to die, and we've all got these sort of biological functions, and you've got to just try and take them on sort of normal terms, and people usually respond to that as well.
They're only human.
They're only human.
Nigel, Lynn, thank you both very much.